la radio libre de Cuenca. Radio Color, la radio libre de Cuenca.
Everybody, welcome back, okay, to What's a Fact. This is our 12th program today, and together with me, I've got Anna, as usual.
Hello.
Hello, Anna. How are you?
I'm good, you?
Okay, I'm all right. I'm all right. Just trying to enjoy the weekend. And Agus, how are you?
I'm okay, Manu. I'm really happy to be here again.
All right, good. So these are our photo teachers, okay? Right, and... as we usually do, let me remind you where we can find this program, okay? So you can find it on radiocolor.es, okay? And where else, Anna?
Also on the radio at 106.2 FM.
Mm-hmm. And Agus, where else?
You can find us on Facebook, so remember it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. So what do we have on What's the Fact today? Well, we will be doing a little bit of grammar and some common mistakes, as you know. We'll be doing some false friends, which I think are useful, and also some idioms. And today's fact on What's the Fact is going to be English literature or British literature. Okay, we will talk about that later, okay? Right, so, first of all, let's do some grammar, okay?
Yeah.
Fine, rather than grammar, I'm gonna explain some differences, the difference between some easily or some commonly confused words. Right, for example, lots of people confuse empathy and sympathy, right? They mean rather similar things, but they're not exactly the same, right? So, for example, empathy is the capacity that someone has, you know, to listen to someone else's problems or to, you know, to understand how people feel, to understand problems, you know, things like that. And sympathy is the capacity to understand, you know, when someone's sorrows, someone's you know, problems as well, right? But sympathy is usually something about something negative, whereas empathy is, you know, the capacity of getting in someone's boots. Okay. right. Also, the difference between among and between, precisely, right? We use among when we have got more than one thing. But you know that among and between, right, they translate the same in Spanish, right? So they mean entre, mm-hmm. right? But because we don't have different words, we need to make the difference between them, right? So among is when we say entre, you know, more than two things, okay? For example, I don't know where my passport is, but it must be among all my papers in the desk, right? On the desk, right? Because there are many papers and you know, and other things. And then between is when we have a duality, if you like, when we have two elements. So, for example, this is a secret, okay? Let's keep it between you and me, right? It's usually two people or two objects, or it could be between one person and another group of people, right? Like, there is something going on between Anna and her mates, okay? So that would be between...
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Very well, Manu, because most of the students just use between.
Yeah, exactly.
What is among? Because among is the word that you had to use if you want to refer more than two different items. Okay.
Exactly. Right. So yeah. So this is, I think this is good information for all our students of English. Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. Now, now these are not really. They're not real words, they are rather initials, okay? And these initials come from Latin, all right? So, this is perhaps for a B2 level or B2 onwards. Sometimes we find EG, okay? EG as initials. Sometimes we find IE as initials too. So what do they mean? Well, EG means, for example, right? And you usually find it in written texts. We don't normally say that. We don't normally use this in oral speeches, right? And EG doesn't come from English, really. It comes from Latin, and it means exempli gratia, right? But it means, for example, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. Fine. And the other one is IE. IE is also some Latin, and it means that is when we want to clarify something. We say we write IE, that is, and it actually in English it means it est, and that's exactly what it means. It means that is. For example, I don't know, when we use something technical and we want to clarify, we might write IE, meaning this. Mm-hmm. All right, good. So I hope you understand that. Let's see some false friends now.
Yeah.
Okay, so the first one is going to be agenda. Okay, agenda has an identical spelling, okay, to the Spanish word agenda, but Agus, does it mean agenda?
No, not at all. It means what you are going to do if you have planned it. Mm-hmm. So it's your, for example, what are you going to do next week? Okay, in your agenda, you know that you are going to, on Monday, you are going to the doctor, Tuesday to the library, or things like that. It's... Mm-hmm. It's tu orden de
del día.
Del día, sí, tu orden del día.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's right. But it never means the book that we use, that we call agenda in Spanish, right? Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't mean that in any case. So what? How do we say agenda? Una agenda. But in English, that's called a diary. Okay, a diary is a book where you write all the appointments and things that you have to do. You know. Okay. And now, the next one is diversion, okay? Diversion has an identical spelling to diversión, but it doesn't mean diversión. So, Agus, what's the meaning of diversion in Spanish?
Es bifurcación. Mm-hmm. Es cuando algo es camino, se divide. Mm-hmm.
Right, so we use it more in a traffic context, mm-hmm. right, on the road. So, Anna, could you give us an example in English with diversion?
Yes. So, for example, if we were driving in a car somewhere and perhaps there was a traffic jam up ahead, we could say we'll have to take a diversion. So mm-hmm. we'll have to avoid the traffic jam and go a different way.
Yep. That's very good. That's a perfect example. Good. And finally, fabric. Fabric pretty much sounds like fabrica. But that's not what it means. What's the actual meaning of fabric, Agus?
In Spanish, fabric would be tejido o tela.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So nothing to do with fabrica.
No. Fabrica, it's factory. Yeah,
that's a factory.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Now, Anna, could you give us an example with fabric?
Yes. So, for example, if I see a piece of clothing in a shop, I could say I don't like the fabric, so I don't like what it's made out of.
Yep, mm-hmm. exactly, because it's, you know, like, so cotton could be a kind of fabric.
Yeah.
Or
polyester. Yeah. That's like a...
Yeah. Okay, yep. Very good. So, you know, agenda, diversion, and fabric. There are lots of false friends between English and Spanish, well, between any language, really, but any language that is somehow similar.
Yep.
Right. Very good. So, if you understood this, let's take a little break now and let's listen to some music. All right. So, what are we going to listen to today, Agus?
Today we are going to, our musical idiom is going to be I Heard It Through the Grapevine. The band is the Creedence Clearwater Revival. I'm sure you are going to enjoy this song because it's really nice. This is an amazing band. I love them.
Really, because I'm I'm going to be totally honest with you. It's the first time that I read or that I hear this name, right? The Creedence Clearwater Revival.
But I'm sure you know them.
Okay.
Yeah, the songs, of course, because they were very, very, very famous.
Okay.
You know, Fortunate Son and many other songs.
Okay, so...
And I Heard It Through the Grapevine. It's also famous, so...
All right.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Yes. So, let's go.
Some other guy that you knew before. You knew all those guys, you know I love you more.
So I do think it sounds familiar now, but not too much though.
I'm sure you know them, Manu, because yeah, they were very famous in the 70s.
But yeah, I wasn't even born in the 70s, right? But yeah, but obviously my musical knowledge cannot compare to yours. Okay, in no way. But thanks anyway for, you know, for illustrating, you know, enlightening our knowledge.
No, I really love them. I love the singer's voice. I find it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to
say it's a little bit broken, yeah. But yeah. Powerful and yeah.
And sweet sometimes too. Uh-huh. I don't know. I cool. love him. And there is a very nice song that I don't want to put it because, or maybe we will do it. It's, do you know Proud Mary, the song?
I think so, yeah.
Probably the famous cover, it was by Tina Turner. Mm-hmm. And Rolling, yeah. Rolling.
Oh,
rolling.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know
yeah.
that one?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a Creedence Clearwater Revival song.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. See, you know, we always learn. Yeah, thanks to this man. All right. So now I heard it through the grapevine. That's one of my favorite idioms in the English language. So Anna, would you be so kind as to explain that to us?
Yes, yeah, sure. So when people use this expression through the grapevine, or also you can say on the grapevine, it's like an unofficial way of hearing something. So, for example, you could say, I heard it on the grapevine that they're planning to make some people redundant. So it's like a rumor or some gossip. It's not like an official statement, but maybe something you hear from a friend or from someone you know, something like this. Mm-hmm. So it's when gossip spreads or some kind of rumor. Mm-hmm. And then in the song we can see that what's going on is that maybe somebody, a woman that he's with, he hears some gossip or a rumor that maybe she is with somebody else. So that's how it fits into the song. And the term that originated in the US and comes from the telegraph system, which was invented in the 19th century by Samuel Morse. So the system required thousands of kilometers of telegraph wire to be installed and held in place several meters above the ground by telegraph poles placed at regular intervals along the telegraph route. So people thought the wires and poles looked like the strings used to train vines. So the telegraph line became known as the grapevine. And during the American Civil War, rumors were often spread via the telegraph line. And when people were asked whether a story was true, they would often say, I heard it through the grapevine. Uh-huh. So that's where the idea comes from.
I think it's a lovely story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wow.
And very interesting.
Yeah.
Cool, yeah. Well, in Spanish, we've got a similar thing, but we don't use grapevine. We use an animal in this case. Yeah. Agus, ¿cómo te has enterado?
Yo solo me lo ha dicho un pajarito.
Me lo ha dicho un pajarito.
And in English, you have this.
Oh yeah, a little birdie told me.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, actually, we've got the same in that case. Yeah.
Cool.
A little birdie told me is the same as I heard it through the grapevine.
Yeah.
Is especially when you don't want to reveal your source,
right.
You don't want to say who told you or how you. I really heard it.
Mm-hmm.
We say that. So we say, me lo dijo un pajarito. All right, good. You know, so today, well, thank you, Anna.
You're welcome.
I've brought some three other idioms, okay, related to vegetables, okay? So, the first one, I love the three of them. I love idioms in general. I always say the same thing, but
me too.
You know, they're a very interesting part of the language. To be full of beans, okay? To be full of beans. Well, it means to be full of energy, you know, to be very energetic, okay? So that's me on Monday, not by the end of the week. So yeah, to be full of beans. Anna, could you please give us an example, maybe?
Yeah, sure. So, for example, if I had a really good night's sleep and I was looking forward to something the next day, mm-hmm. I could say when I woke up, oh, I'm full of beans, I've slept really well, and now mm-hmm. I'm really excited for the day.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And, you know, I think this is a very British idiom. Yeah. I don't think Americans say this.
No, probably not.
Okay, good. Now, the next one is to be as cool as a cucumber. Okay, to be as cool as a cucumber, right? Agus is laughing.
Yeah, because I like them.
You like it. Right. It means, it doesn't mean to be cool, like, you know, it means to be calm, okay, to be extremely calm about something, especially when you face a stressful situation, right, we say that. So, Agus, could you give us an example, maybe?
Yeah. For example, if you ask to me, were you nervous at your driving exam or something like that?
Agus, were you nervous during your driving exam?
Not at all. Actually, I was as cool as a cucumber, so I was not nervous at all. I was so calm, and the driving test was excellent.
So you passed.
Yeah, I passed.
So you kept calm, you know, at a stressful situation.
Yeah.
Okay, that's cool. Do you know the keep calm and mm-hmm. you know and. Plenty of things, right? I think it should be changed, you know. It should be changed to, you know, be as cool as a cucumber and, you know. Right, good. And finally, a couch potato, okay? What do you think a couch potato is? Because it doesn't... It's not what it literally means. Well, a couch potato is a person who doesn't like physical activity and prefers to sit down, probably to watch TV. Right, so it's a kind of person who, you know, lays on the sofa and watches TV all day and does nothing else.
Me okay. after work.
Sorry?
Me after work.
Are you a couch potato?
Yes, I am. I've been recognized.
I don't believe you.
I would like to be, but I'm. Unfortunately, I'm not, but I would like.
Okay. Some people are like that. So, Anna, would you mm-hmm. suggest any further examples, maybe?
Mm-hmm. So, for example, if I said to you, would you like to do something after work, maybe go out and have a drink or something like mm-hmm. this, and you were to say to me, oh, no, I just want to stay at home and watch TV, I'd say, don't be such a couch potato.
Yeah, it's a very good example.
So, remember, beans, cucumbers, and potatoes.
Yeah. So we've got our very own meal today.
Yeah.
All right. You know, I think idioms are very enjoyable, yeah. and we once again encourage our listeners to, you know, to use idioms, and especially, you know, I think it's a good idea to try to use idioms in your exams, in life in general, but in your official certificate exams, I think it's a very good idea. It gives you, it makes you stand from the crowd and stand out from the crowd, and yeah, it's cool. It's simply cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. It sounds more natural. Right. You know what also is cool? You know, British literature. Okay, yeah. British literature. Right. So, well, as we advance at the beginning, we'll be talking about that. You know, this is an English-speaking program, and we always try to talk about lots of anything related to the English language and culture. You know, and a very important part of the language and the culture as well is literature. Right. And today we're going to be talking about the literature in Britain, okay? And maybe on another session we'll be talking about American literature, maybe Irish, maybe South African literature, right? But today we're going to do British. Right, so guys, to begin with, what's your favourite book? Anna, do you have a favourite book in English? I suppose you do.
Yes, I do. I would say my favourite, or maybe the book that I've read that's most memorable for me, is Animal Farm.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
By George Orwell.
Yeah. And I really like it. I suppose it's famous, obviously, yeah. but I think it's cool because obviously it's like political, but also mm-hmm. fictional at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I suppose if people don't know what it's about, I could explain it a bit.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so the idea behind the book is, well, it's set on like a farm, but the animals are the characters. And basically what happens is they are being controlled, obviously, by the humans who run the farm. And obviously the idea is that they're not happy with this and they want to be free and to be equal. So they take over the farm and the idea is that they'll all be equal and they will all have equal roles. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that some of the animals take control. Mm-hmm. So it becomes similar to the situation before. And it's like a dictatorship, kind of. Yeah. And they control what all the other animals do. And it's supposed to be related to, like, Stalinism.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that idea of, like, a dictatorship. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really interesting.
It was the pig, the one who...
Yeah, the pigs. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, and they take over and become, like, humans, almost.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. It's funny because, you know, if you don't read it, you know, in depth, or if you regard the book from outside, it mm-hmm. looks like a children's book or something.
Yeah.
But obviously, when you read it and you see, you know, what each animal represents, mm-hmm. you get to see that it's a very powerful political kind of criticism. And,
thought-provoking, I think mm-hmm. you could
say. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And also the language, although it sounds like a really complicated topic, the language in the book is actually quite simple, mm-hmm. I think, so...
Yeah, to make people see, you know, to talk to people in very simple terms, to, you know, for them to discover what's going on back then. And I'm going to talk about George Orwell mm-hmm. later on, mm-hmm. As he belongs to the 20th century.
Right.
But thank you very much, Anna. That was a brilliant explanation of it. Okay, and Agus, do you have a favorite British book?
Yep, I had to say that my favorite English book is The Treasure Island, mm-hmm. because I don't know why, but I read it when I was a child, and I read it like 2 years ago, because I remember the idea, the scene where the story takes place, and I really like it. Mm-hmm. There are also some films about it, and I like the story. Mm-hmm. I like pirates and everything, and now there is a TV series that is placed just before the Captain Flint's treasure uh-huh. and everything, and it's Black Sails. I strongly recommend it to you.
Right, yeah, I think I started watching that series, but for some reason it stopped. But yeah, I remember I liked it.
Yeah. Wow, good cool. actors, and the plot is okay, and I really mm-hmm. like it. John Silver mm-hmm. and everything.
Yeah. Okay. So your recommendation is Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. My recommendation, or at least one of my favorite books written in English by a British British writer, is Brave New World. Okay, in Spanish it was translated as Un Mundo Feliz. It is by Aldous Huxley, okay, he's British, and it was written in 1932, right? And this story talks about a utopia, but in theory it's a utopia where everybody seems to be happy and there aren't wars going on anymore, and everybody has a job and everybody has, you know, like... the affairs, but then it's not a utopia, it's a dystopia. That means it's the opposite, actually, right? It's it takes place in the future, right? And it's amazing to see, or to read, how this dystopia is coming true. Like it was written like 90 years ago, and nowadays, we see that some of these things are becoming true, and we're going we're getting into this dystopia, and it's incredible. So it's a little bit pessimistic, but I liked it. I must have read it like 3 or 4 times. It's not that difficult to read, and it's not very long. So, you know, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, that would be my book.
It's interesting. I like what you have said about it's about the future, but mm-hmm. all the other stories that a world and imaginative world, all these stories for a no far future mm-hmm. are becoming true. Yep. All that stories and also TV series, of course, they talk about things that they are not placed in our world, mm-hmm. but there are some things that are coming true.
Yeah.
It's
or that they that might become, you know, real in a few years. Yeah. So that's scary. That's really scary.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's not make them true. Right. Okay. So how about giving like an outline of the history of British literature or literature in the British Isles? Let me begin with Old English literature.
Okay.
Also called Anglo-Saxon literature, right? And but it encompasses the surviving literature written in Old English in Anglo-Saxon England. Okay, that would be the period after the settlement of the Saxons, the Jutes, and the Angles. I think we talked about weeks ago. You know, in the mid 5th century, right? You know, after the Romans left the island. And it goes on up to the Norman conquest, okay, in 1066. That's a very important date. So these works include genres such as epic poetry, hagiography, sermons, Bible translations. You know, it's all very religious, as you can see, but also legal works, chronicles, and riddles, okay? So it's varied. It's more or less varied. In total, there are about 400 surviving manuscripts from the period. Okay, and it's—I would say it's quite interesting because it's old and it's mysterious sometimes, and it's very mythological. Some of the epic stories are very mythological, and but also I must warn you that if you decided to read any works from this period, you'd be surprised to see how different the English was at the time. You know, nothing to do with present day English. It has changed incredibly, right? So, you know, you will have to make an incredible effort to try to understand just the gist of it, right? At least that's my experience. Okay, so August, can you tell us some more information about this period?
Of course. Oral tradition was very strong in early English culture, and most literary works were written to be performed. It's like in Spanish case, mm-hmm. We have Cantar del Mio Cid,
yeah.
It's the same, it was oral tradition, and after that, it was written.
Because basically, most people couldn't read, they were illiterate, so they couldn't read.
So you have performed, and, yep.
You had to perform it for people to see, you had to sing it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So epic poems were very popular, and some, including Beowulf, have survived to present day. Beowulf is the most famous work in Old English and has achieved national epic status in England, despite being set in Scandinavia. The only surviving manuscript is the Noel Codex, the precise date of which is debated, but most estimate place it close to the year 1000. Beowulf is the conventional title, and its composition is dated between the 8th and the early 11th century.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you know what Beowulf means?
No.
It's funny. It's like a riddle in itself. Because Beowulf means literally it's a bee wolf. So it's like a wolf that is looking for bees. So that would be a bear. Okay, the name would be a bear because it's like a wolf, okay, in inverted commas, because it's hairy and it's like a beast, and you know he looks for the bees which make honey, because bears eat honey. So that's the composition of the name. Mm-hmm. Okay, as a curiosity.
Okay, thank you, man.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Anna, how about mm-hmm. the next period? Okay, that'll mm-hmm. be Middle English literature.
Yes, so after the Norman conquest of England, which was in 1066, the written form of the Anglo-Saxon language became a lot less common. So under the influence of the new aristocracy, French became the standard language, and this was in courts, parliament, and in polite society. So as the invaders integrated, their language and literature mingled with that of the natives, and the Norman dialects of the ruling class became Anglo-Norman. So from then until the 12th century, Anglo-Saxon underwent a gradual transition into what we know as Middle English. So political power was no longer in English hands. So the West Saxon literary language had no more influence than any other dialect, and Middle English literature was written in the many dialects that corresponded to the region, history, culture, and background of individual writers.
Mm-hmm. It is precisely in that period where the English language starts being a lot less English, we can say, because mm-hmm. It mingled, as Anna said, with the Norman, with the French language, and this is where we get like lots and lots of long words from French into the English language,
yeah.
Which for us Spaniards is great news, because thanks to that, yeah. the English lexicon nowadays is full of Latin-based words, so that makes it a lot easier for us to understand, you know, in terms of vocabulary, mm-hmm. right? So so well done, thank you.
Good
thank
choice.
You, thank
Good.
You, Normans. Right, but let's go back to literature, right? So in this period, in Middle English, religious literature continued to enjoy popularity, and hagiographies, by the way, like the lives of saints, okay? But many hagiographies were written and adapted and translated. For example, the life of Saint Audrey, okay, that would be a very good example. Okay, right, also in this period, we find the first adaptation of the legends of King Arthur, right, and the Knights of the Round Table, right, which is originally of Norman French origin. Okay, so that was another good contact, you know, like it was not just a matter of invading the country, but also, you know, with invasions, sometimes you get like good, like advantages. Okay, so also Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is a late 14th century Middle English alliterative romance. It is one of the best known Arthurian stories of an established type known as the beheading game. Okay.
Mm-hmm. In Middle English, mm-hmm. Middle English lasted until the 1470s, when the Chancery Standard, a London-based form of English, became widespread, and the printing press started to standardize the language. Chaucer is best known today for the Canterbury Tales. This is a collection of stories written in the Middle English, mostly in verse, although some are in prose, that are presented as a part of a storytelling contest by a group of pilgrims as they travel together from Southwark to the shrine of St. Thomas Becket at Canterbury Cathedral. So it's interesting. Like
Chaucer, yeah. Chaucer is probably the best-known writer in this period, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember studying him on my first year at university. Did you get to study him as well, Anna? Do you remember?
I think when I was at university, we had to look at these different periods mm-hmm. of time. So I remember his name mm-hmm. coming
yeah.
up.
So he's famous.
Okay, but let's move on. Okay, and we bump into the English Renaissance. Okay, so Anna, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. So this period was from 1500 to 1660, and I remember doing about this in history at school. And this is like the Renaissance is the rebirth of learning. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. So after William Caxton introduced the printing press in England in 1476, vernacular literature flourished. And the English Renaissance was a cultural and artistic movement in England dating from the late 15th to the 17th century. And it's associated with the pan-European Renaissance that is usually regarded as beginning in Italy in the late 14th century.
Yeah, it began in Italy in all fields, like in art, mm-hmm. and in literature, of course. And then it spread it all over Europe. Mm-hmm. And that was obviously a very important period. In England, from 1558 till 1603, that's what we call the Elizabethan period, obviously, because Queen Elizabeth was reigning there. I'm going to remark to genres in literature back in time. There'll be poetry and drama. Okay, poetry. We have got Edmund Spenser, right? He was one of the most important poets of the Elizabethan period, and he's the author of The Faery Queen, okay, in the 1590s. It's an epic poem and fantastical allegory celebrating the Tudor dynasty and Elizabeth I. Okay, that'd be the most important poet. And then in drama, I don't know if you've ever heard of this person here, but his name is apparently William Shakespeare. Are you familiar with him? Does it sound in the rings?
Is a brand of gin?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So, William Shakespeare, he was born in 1564 and he died in 1666. Legend has it he died on the same day, exactly on the same day as Miguel de Cervantes died, okay? But, it's still a legend, I think. Well, Shakespeare stands out in this period as a poet and playwright as yet unsurpassed. I mean, he was an incredible playwright. Shakespeare wrote plays in a variety of genres, including histories, tragedies, comedies, and the late romances or tragic comedies. Okay, Shakespeare's career continues in the Jacobean period, which is the next one. Okay, I am sure that you studied Shakespeare at university, Anna. So I did. So did I. And I must say that, literature was not my cup of tea, mm-hmm. okay, during my studies. But I must admit that Shakespeare, I really loved reading Shakespeare, especially his plays. Mm-hmm. I think he's incredible. The way he plays with the feelings, with human feelings, human psychology, the stories, all the power of the, how powerful they are. I think that was incredible. Mm-hmm. All right, so Agus, how about the next period?
The next period is called Jacobean period, and it starts in the 1603 when the Elizabethan period ends. And ends in 1625. So in the early 17th century, Shakespeare wrote the so-called problem plays, as well as the number of his best-known tragedies, including Macbeth and King Lear. In his final period, Shakespeare turned to the romance and tragicomedy and completed three more major plays, including The Tempest. In poetry, George Chapman is remembered chiefly for his famous translation in 1616 of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey into English verse. Mm-hmm. So this is interesting too, because it's international works, mm-hmm. everybody knows them.
Who's never heard of, Macbeth or Hamlet, yeah. or, King Lear, The Tempest, that's true. Okay, very good. Well, after that, we get to the Restoration Age. So, Anna, tell us about that, please.
So, the official break in literary culture caused by censorship and radically moralist standards under Cromwell's Puritan regime created a gap in literary tradition, allowing a seemingly fresh start for all forms of literature after the Restoration. So, prose in the Restoration period were dominated by Christian religious writing, but the Restoration also saw the beginning of two genres that would dominate later periods, which were fiction and journalism. And religious writing often strayed into political and economic writing, just as political and economic writing implied or directly addressed religion. So the Restoration was also the time when John Locke wrote many of his philosophical works, and his two treatises on government, which later inspired the thinkers in the American Revolution.
Wow.
Cool. Right, so let's get to the 18th century, okay? Well, the first part of the 18th century is called Augustan literature, right? And that goes from 1700 to 1750, right? 50 years. So during the 18th century, literature reflected the worldview of the Age of Enlightenment, okay? Also called Age of Reason. But that would be a rational and scientific approach to religious, social, political, and economic issues that promoted a secular view of the world and a general sense of progress and perfectibility, right? So quite the opposite, right? Quite the opposite from what we had right before. Now, led by the philosophers who were inspired by the discoveries of the previous century, by people like Isaac Newton and the writings of Descartes, John Locke and Francis Bacon. Well, the English novel has generally been seen as beginning with Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. Okay, I remember reading that book my second year at university, and it is a good book, of course, but I remember the professor that I had, she was the most boring person I've ever had to listen to. You know, it was first time in the month. Sorry, this is a little bit, you know, off topic, but I had to say it. You know, it was on a Monday morning, you know, 8:30 in the morning, with this lady. You know, I just wanted to sleep, and we had to read and study Robinson Crusoe's, and not a good experience. Yeah. So, yeah, but it is a good book. Please read Robinson Crusoe.
You wanted
now
to be as cool as a cucumber.
But I was rather as dead as a dodo, you know, you know, something like that. Okay, we'll see that idiom another day. Okay.
Okay. After Augustan literature comes the Age of Sensibility. This period is also sometimes described as the Age of Johnson. Samuel Johnson, often referred to as Dr. Johnson, was an English author who made lasting contributions to English literature as a poet, essayist, moralist, literary critic, biographer, editor, and lexicographer. Johnson has been described as arguably the most distinguished man of letters in English history. After 9 years of work, Johnson's A Dictionary of English Language was published in 1755, and it had a far-reaching effect on modern English and has been described as one of the greatest single achievements of a scholarship.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very, very important dictionary. Okay, and this was a time where, you know, most dictionaries and grammar were being made, you know, like there wasn't much before that. Okay, so it's also a very important, a very prolific time in terms of lexicography and grammar. Yep. Okay, not just literature. Anna, let's get to Romanticism.
So this was the period between 1798 and 1837. So Romanticism was an artistic, literary and intellectual movement that originated in Europe towards the end of the 18th century. Romanticism arrived later in other parts of the English-speaking world. And the Romantic period was one of the major social changes in England and Wales because of the depopulation of the countryside and the rapid development of overcrowded industrial cities that took place in the period around 1750 and 1850. So the movement of so many people in England was the result of two forces. The first, the agriculture revolution, agricultural, sorry, and also the industrial revolution. Mm-hmm. So there are two authors that we can look at here. So the first one is Mary Shelley, who was born in 1797 and is remembered as the author of Frankenstein, which mm-hmm. was from 1818.
And I would like to remark the importance of this work, because not just the work itself is very... It's a breakthrough in literature, but also, you know, everything that comes after Frankenstein, all the legend, all the films and even series mm-hmm. that come from this idea of you know, Frankenstein's monster, right? Mm-hmm. Apart from the films that Agus can tell us about in a minute, I would like to point out a series that might not very famous, but you know, it's a series I watched some time ago and I find it really nice. It's called The Frankenstein Chronicles. It's a British series, and you have to watch it. It's very special. It's a little bit creepy sometimes, but I really liked it. I really enjoyed it, and it mixes literature with Mary Shelley, and I mean Mary Shelley is in the series, mm-hmm. And also action and science and science fiction is really cool. Cool. I recommend The Frankenstein Chronicles.
Okay, very nice. I didn't want to talk about the film. There is also, you know, there is a very famous film about Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Based in Mary Shelley's book. Mm-hmm. The author is Kenneth Branagh. Mm-hmm. And who performs many, many works of Shakespeare, too. Mm-hmm. But I really want to talk about what we said before. Remember the science fiction, no far future, now what is happening, the experiments with humans. Now there is a movie called Lazarus. You know it?
No, but it's about the same legend, isn't it?
Yeah. Is the same, something that who has died, mm-hmm. now he's alive again after some experiments.
Wow. So
it's always the same.
Cool.
Cool. Okay, and another very famous author that we can look at is Jane Austen. So Jane Austen's works critique the novels of sensibility of the second half of the 18th century and a part of the transition to 19th century realism. So the plots in her novels, for example, Pride and Prejudice, which was written in 1813, Emma in 1815, were fundamentally comic and highlight the dependence of women in marriage to secure social standing and economic security. Mm-hmm. So, I remember studying these as well. Well, Pride and Prejudice more, I think.
I think I didn't read any of you know, of them, but yeah, I remember studying them. And Emma, yeah. You know, and actually, we've got some female writers here, you know, coming on stage. And actually, the next period will be the Victorian novel, all right? And it was in the Victorian era, okay, 1837 to 1901, that the novel became the leading literary genre in English. And women played an important part in this rising popularity, both as authors and as readers. Okay, but also we find a very, very famous English writer called Charles Dickens. Okay, he lived between 1812 and 1870, And boy, he came up on the literary scene in the late 1830s and soon became probably the most famous novelist in the history of English literature, or at least one of the most famous ones. Dickens fiercely satirized various aspects of society, including the workhouse in Oliver Twist or the failures of the legal system in Bleak House. Okay, and obviously he wrote many other novels, usually criticizing, you know, the poor conditions of the English society, the different English classes, the working class, you know. I liked Dickens. I liked studying Dickens. Okay. Also, we find Robert Louis Stevenson, and I think Agus mentioned him before. He was an important Scottish writer at the end of the 19th century, and he is the author of The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, okay, written in 1886, okay, and also the historical novel Kidnapped, okay, 1886, right? Mm-hmm. And Agus...
Okay, let's continue with another genre. It's fiction one. Now let's talk about Bram Stoker's horror history of Dracula. It belongs to a number of literary genres, including vampire literature, horror fiction, gothic, novel, and invasion literature. Okay, we have also Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes, that is a brilliant work. It's a London-based consulting detective, famous for his intellectual prowess. Conan Doyle wrote 4 novels and 56 short stories featuring Holmes from 1880 to 1907, with a final case in 1914. All but 4 Holmes stories are narrated by the Holmes' friend, assistant, and biographer, Dr. Watson. The Lost World literary genre was inspired by real stories and archaeological discoveries by imperial adventurers. H. Rider Haggard wrote one of the earliest examples, King Solomon's Mines. I don't know if you know that story. There is also a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Contemporary European politics and diplomatic maneuverings informed Anthony Hope's Ruritarian adventure novel, The Prisoner of Zenda.
Mm-hmm.
So... we have many examples of literature here that I think are quite famous, and mm-hmm. now it sounds more familiar than Chaucer for me.
Mm-hmm. Elementary, my dear Watson. Okay. Right. And Anna, mm-hmm. Can you continue? Can you tell us a little bit about children's literature?
Yes. Maybe. Okay. So literature for children developed as a separate genre, and some works in this period, which became internationally known, for example, those by the author Lewis Carroll. So, for example, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, mm-hmm. done in 1865, and its sequel, Through the Looking Glass. And this author is actually from a place near where I live.
Oh,
cool. He comes from a place called Darsbury, which is a county where I live. And uh-huh. it's really not that far. So
cool.
It's maybe about, I think it's like 15 minutes away.
Wow. Uh-huh. So cool.
It's cool. Another author, Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island is also an example. And Treasure Island was written in 1883 and is a classic pirate adventure. So at the end of the Victorian era and leading into the Edwardian era, Beatrix Potter was an author and illustrator of this period, best known for her children's books, which featured animal characters. In her 30s, she published the highly successful children's book, The Tale of Peter Rabbit, in 1902.
Mm-hmm.
And she eventually went on to publish 23 more children's books and became a very wealthy author.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Right, and we get into the 20th century, all right? So we can begin with a Nobel Prize laureate, William Golding, and his allegorical novel Lord of the Flies, okay, written or published in 1954, right, which explores how culture created by man fails, using as an example a group of British schoolboys marooned on a deserted island. And I have not read the book myself, but I have seen the film. It's a very old film as well, in black and white. But I think it was brilliant, and it perfectly represents, you know, the higher a kid's in modern human societies. Like, you know, like there is always the bully and the bossy boy and the you know, all the different roles in society represented by school children on a deserted island. I think it was very interesting to read that. But also we find Agatha Christie, okay, you know, born in 1890 he died in 1976, not so long ago. She was an important crime writer of novels, okay, and short stories and plays, she's best remembered for her 80 detective novels, as well as her successful plays for the West End Theatre, right? One of these detective novels is The Clocks, which I read a couple of years ago, and I liked it, you know, even if it was written many years ago. You know, it still looks like, you know, exciting, and you want to read more. And okay, so The Clocks, for example. Then we find Ian Fleming, okay? He was the creator of the James Bond character, right? You know, everybody knows about him. And then C.S. Lewis is the author of the Screwtape Letters, The Chronicles of Narnia, and the Space Trilogy, okay? So, you know, these are very important works as well, and they're very perfectly modern, let's say. Mm-hmm. Then finally, J.K. Rowling, who wrote the highly successful Harry Potter series. And actually, before we checked that if you Google best-known English authors, you get Shakespeare, and right after Shakespeare, you get J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. right? In all the English literature history, you know, she is second one on Google.
Yeah, and I think she's supposed to be like the best-selling British author.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm not surprised. Mm-hmm. Okay,
she has become a very wealthy kid.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and you know, right at the beginning, Anna commented on Animal Farm by George Orwell, and I would like to talk just a little bit about another novel by George Orwell. It's 1984, and actually, this is another dystopic literary work, okay, and it's very similar to Brave New World in many ways, as it talks about, you know, the future, okay, namely in 1984, sorry, and in this case, everything is controlled, you know, at work, and there is Big Brother, a sort of entity that controls everybody and sees everything. There's lots of CCTV cameras all around, and again, it's a dystopia that we don't want to get to. Okay, it was written in 1949, but it's scary to get to think, you know, how similar, you know, present day society is getting. Okay, mm-hmm. Now we've finished with the literature today on What's the Fact, and you know, please tell us what's your favorite book, okay, and tell us a little bit about it if you want. On radiocolor.es, also on Facebook, on our Facebook page, right? And now, Agus, is there anything on this weekend?
Of course, yes. We have many things. The first two that I would like to talk about is there are two different contests. The first one name is Concurso Buscadores de Especies 2. So it was won last year, I suppose. It's placed in the Museo de las Ciencias de Cuenca. You can join that contest till the 15th of May. Okay. The second one is ends so close, the 30th of April. and it's el cuarto concurso de maquetas of Radio Color. So if you have a band, if you are from Cuenca or the region, or you live here, if you are from Madrid but you live or you study here, you can be a part of that contest. So if you want to participate, just send us some songs that you have with your band, and after that there will be a jury. There are two kinds of jury. The first one is the public, okay, and the second one is the Radio Color members. So what you can win? You can win to record a song, three songs, or a full CD if you win the contest. So I really encourage you to participate in...
And 1 million euro. Yeah. Oh, no, sorry.
That's
no.
For the staff of Radio Color. Okay, then we have some speeches. The first one is going to be performed by Alfredo Crespo. It's a part of the ciclo de conferencias sesiones de DJs. It's called Malos Tiempos para la Lírica. And it's a part of the program of the Babylon Festival. So it's going to be on the 5th of May at 7 o'clock in the Faculty of Educación y Humanidades in Cuenca. Okay. Another thing that you can participate is an exposición Paleofonografías de Javier Ariza, that it will take place in Fundación Antonio Pérez. You know, it's in the old town. Mm-hmm. And it ends on the 7th of May. There is another exhibition. It's called Lira, Alma de Bosque. And it will be in Centro Cultural Aguirre. And it's going to finish so close on the 30th of April, too.
Yeah, so hurry up.
Yeah, hurry up. Otherwise, you will miss it. So that's all for this week, Manu.
So that was all on What's the Fact. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much, guys, for being here with me. So see you next week, Anna. Mm-hmm.
See you next week.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you. And Agus.
Bye-bye, Manu, and bye-bye, audience. I really want to be here next week.
Okay, so am I. So this was Manuel García. Thanks very much for listening. See you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Radio Color. La radio libre de Cuenca. Radio Color, la radio libre de Cuenca.
That's the problem,